You're listening to What's Up Digital Lending, the podcast that explores the exciting world of digital lending. We make a deep dive into the most important issues and talk to the leading minds of the ecosystem.
Hi, everybody. My guests today in this episode number 14 are Tamara Kumpurst, Head of Banking at Tactile, Kimmo Rüdkönen, Founder and CEO at Getincome, Peter Hiekman, Vice President Sales at Finapi, and Patrick Wolf, Partner at Graf von Westfalen. My name is Konstantin Fabricius, and I'm the host of this podcast. What is it about today? Digital lending is on the verge of dramatic changes. With open finance, Europe will have a data economy in which fintechs will be able to obtain much more detailed financial information about potential borrowers. However, open finance combined with AI has the potential to significantly improve this outcome. That's because AI requires humongous amounts of data, which can be perfectly obtained through the open data economy that the EU is targeting. On this basis, much more accurate risk assessments can be carried out, which can lead to a much better fitting interest rate and also help to avoid the risk of loan defaults more efficiently. But is it really all that great for consumers and suitable for avoiding disparities to their disadvantage, as I tell it here? Or is the story perhaps quite different? Let's find out in this episode. Before we start, please listen carefully to the following. The content of this podcast is expressly not to be considered investment advice, but is intended solely for your information. We do not assume any liability and will not share any profits. Okay, let's start talking. Welcome, folks. Great to have you in the show.
Hi, Konstantin.
Yay, hi.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for inviting us.
Would you be so kind as to briefly introduce yourselves? Who are you and which company are you speaking for today? 2-3 sentences. It's just that the audience is able to identify your voices. Tamara, would you perhaps like to start?
Yeah, happy to. My name is Tamara. I lead the European business of Tactile. Background is in banking. I've been in the industry for almost 10 years. What is Tactile doing? Tactile provides modern technology for risk management to lending companies, what means we have to set up an agile and flexible core infrastructure and help our customers to get access to all kind of data. Peter, do you want to be next?
Thanks, Jo. Yeah, I'm from FinAPI, so we are a banking API provider. So so part of our business is already protected from PSD2 regulation. And we're heavily inside of the open finance. Yeah. So we call this beyond PSD2. So we are looking forward to the FIDO regulation, which protects our business, but even more extends our possibilities in the market and bridging to our podcast, surely using AI. Yeah. So we are doing 20 million calls per day account of financial institutions, and AI runs on top to increase our understanding and financial insights.
Great. Thank you. Kimmo?
Sure. Hi, everyone. I'm Kimmo, and long-term fintech entrepreneur, and here today talking in behalf of Getincome.com. So what we do, we're an investment platform that essentially enables people to invest in loans, and we cooperate with a whole lot of global loan originators or loan companies. So we keep our, how would I say, finger on the pulse of fintech lending by offering this. So yeah, hope I can contribute nicely to what's going on in the market and how AI is affecting it.
Great. Welcome, Patrick.
So yeah, thank you. My name's Patrick. I'm a lawyer with GVW, Graf von Westfalen, a law firm in Germany. I've been advising on banking and especially banking supervisory law for, I don't know, 15 plus years. And so obviously, the issues we're going to talk about today, which are also driven by regulatory issues, obviously, are something that we reviewed and had a look at. So I'm looking forward to the discussion.
Great. Thank you. Yeah, let's jump into today's discussion. And let's broach today's topic, access to finance for consumers.
What's up in consumer financing in Europe, guys? What's the current state of play and market development? Kimmo, may I ask you to begin as you are representing the fintech lenders faction today?
Yeah, I'm happy to start. Obviously, we've already seen quite a bit of regulation coming up in the last 10 years, which has affected a lot of the companies. Direct lending, I would say, in Europe is starting to die, unfortunately. And we can get to why it's unfortunate at a later stage. But what I see happening a lot is companies going from direct lending to moving to sort of an ecosystem lending. So buy now, pay later is making headway into different product categories. I mean, you can order food even these days from Wolt or Bolt with a buy now, pay later. So that we see e-commerce, healthcare lending, we see, you know, education packages in some countries going. Litigation lending is lifting up. So if you need to sue someone, you get a loan to cover for the legal cost. So it really is moving into this sort of like service or product-based lending instead of normal cash loans, which used to be the craze when I started my journey in fintech.
And what's your take, Tamara, Peter, and Patrick?
Yeah, I think I can go next. And what we see trending currently are mainly two things. One is everybody wants to achieve profitability while being compliant with all regulatory requirements. And we all know that regulatory requirements get more strict and more strict over time. And the second thing is being customer-centric is no longer just a nice to have, but a must have. And so super important to get a holistic view of the customer, to know the customer really, really well, to be able to sell the right product at the right time, and also to make a very thorough risk assessment before working with the customer. And that are the two main trends we see in 2024 and also expect to continue in 2025.
Maybe adding what Tamara, you opened, I think there is a lack in offering in the market and the customer expectations. If you take Gen Z and Alpha, they are heavily demanding smart journeys, and you have the EPL perspective, so short decisions, and you have a lack of digital journeys, credit routes. If I take the German market, which is a pretty huge one, two out of three decisions are classic or manual. They're not digital, they're not hybrid, classic manual processes. And if I add on these mismatch on offering and demands, I take the monitor of Schufa, which is the leading credit bureau in Germany, has been opened last week, and 53% of consumer which have signed a loan in the last 6 months are under trouble to pay back, 53%. And the increase of last year to this year in the first new negative entry on the score increased by 20%. So there's a huge pressure on the market right now. Hopefully serviced with the right digital journeys. Yeah.
Maybe I'll round that off from a legal perspective. I think everything that you described will be, you know, subject to the changes that are mostly driven from the EU and, you know, all of the regulatory frameworks that are coming from there. I think, you know, the consumer credit directive is obviously one, but there's more, especially in the setups that Kimmo mentioned, where you have a service or product-based or related financing, where also issues of business models with payment services, you know, come into play, and there you have PSD3 on the horizon and PSR. So I think those are but obviously FIDA as well, with questions of how to use data. I think that's something that's from a legal perspective we have to see and evaluate and hopefully tell all of you what you can do, and they can do a lot, but maybe not everything. So I think that's from a legal perspective, especially how that all of that will be transposed into national law, except for the PSR, which will be, you know, directly, which will, you know, have direct effect. But I think it's going to be interesting times.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. We will get back to many of the things you have just mentioned at a later stage. Just one more question for you, Kimmo. Where do you see the competition between bank lenders and non-bank lenders in Europe? Who's currently ahead?
That's a good one. I think, like, you know, fintech obviously has an edge still, mainly because, you know, they are not, and it, depending on the local regulator, obviously. I mean, usually the banks are regulated by the national bank or the local FSA. And they obviously have different levels of non-performing loans they can accept. They have more strict risk models that they need to adhere to. You know, and the banks generally can't carry as many NPLs on their balance sheet without affecting capital ratios. So in a way, fintech lenders still today are more, how would I say, flexible due to the less regulation, right? So I would say still today, the big BNPL, obviously, buy now, pay later ones, others, they have an edge over normal lending, and many of them also give direct loans. So the buy now, pay later is sort of a data collection exercise. That with those microtransactions, you get the performance data of the customer, which is always stronger than the application data. And then essentially you are able to score the person better. And then you offer a direct loan and you can do that profitably. Banks, on the other hand, you know, they have the massively much more cheaper funding. So I think in big ticket loans, such as, you know, mortgages, perhaps even credit cards, they are ahead. But there's a place for both of those. And yeah, I wanted to kind of touch on that sort of regulatory paradoxes that we have. There's multiple, you know, at first phase, the regulator says that, you know, you should have, or let's say EU, the CCD3, for example, APR caps, unified market, making life more difficult for lenders, not just because they would be profiting too much. That's not the case. But what the regulators don't necessarily understand is that, you know, you do your scoring. You base it, what's your acceptable level of default? What are you earning from that single loan? If that doesn't match, and that's obviously a default rate versus your pricing. If you can't match with pricing, you can't serve certain people. So that's one paradox. At one say, you know, everybody should get credit. But at the other end, they say, well, you know, the prices need to be lower. So you're at the crossroads of saying, well, if my default rate is 20%, then in that category, 80% of the customers would be able to pay back. But in order to not to serve those 20, I also can't serve those 80. So you need to cut the whole segment out. So there's a lot of things like this going on where I think the regulator might not necessarily be very logical. And the same thing applies to open data or open banking as well. You know, you mentioned discrimination concerns. Oh, I know I can go on about this, but maybe somebody else has a has something to supplement or to add to my monologue.
Just maybe on the paradox, I think indeed pricing is obviously one, but the creditworthiness assessment, it has a paradox built into it as well, because, you know, it's made clear now. It was in Germany, at least, it was clear before for most loans, but that the creditworthiness assessment has to be done in the interest of the consumer. So, you know, that they don't take up loans that they can't repay and become over indebted. And on the other hand, you know, there's a worry about discrimination and not everyone actually getting a loan. So the lenders are sort of in a bit of a fix that on the one hand, you know, they're not allowed to be too open and, you know, to be too willing to provide funds. And on the other hand, they're not supposed to discriminate. And then, you know, the question of databases, etc. So I think, Kimo, you're absolutely right that, you know, those paradoxes will have to be seen how we can.
Yeah. And I mean, and that's a different, right? So you have the cost or let's say your expense income analysis, which you can do, and you in many countries actually now you finally get positive data, so you can see what loans are open and you can weed out those customers who are clearly over indebted and shouldn't be serviced anymore. It used to be negative credit marking was the only indicator. Now you get a bit of better when you can say that this person has loaded up on too much credit, we can't service. But then you have this massive paradox of saying, like, you know, okay, we want open data and open banking, and this will improve better scoring decisions. Because in the end, it's all about how much data you can get. And AI can be used to analyze, but the question is, how much data, what data, is it relevant? You know, the data is better data, more data, better decisions. But then you have these funny things there, like you mentioned, like discrimination, right? So, you know, we're not talking about ethnic profiling in that sense, but you can't profile a person in even in a way of, you know, some have said that it's You know, it's not right to see if they're a male or a female. You know, that shouldn't bear any difference. But at the same time, as a lender, you should be giving out better credit, more credit to more people. But then for this kind of like the trying to put everybody into an equal basket and not to discriminate anyone, we're taking relevant data points out, you know, and then trying to supplement them with open banking. So I think really the regulator should, or the regulator should consider it this way. It's either or. Either you give all the data and you say that payment behavior and demographic data does not discriminate. It is that, you know, so that's not a basis of discrimination if you get all the data. Or they should say, okay, well, you know, we limit this data and then, well, then a lot of the people will not be able to get credit. You know, I remember that kind of ties down to what Konstantin was saying before is I remember the question about fintechs and banks. For a long time in Finland, the banks had access to only to a better register, like better customer, not even their own internal bank data, which is obviously great, but I mean like a public register, which was only allowed from the demographic, from population register. They could get inputs that the fintechs couldn't. And then at the same time, they were saying to fintechs, well, why are you making so bad decisions? Why are so many customers defaulting? So there's a really schizophrenic situation, and I think it's still ongoing.
Maybe to quickly react, Kimmo, what I'm hearing, maybe also what you've answered to the initial question of who is like the, or who has the competitive advantage. Is it more the fintech or is it the traditional banks? And what you were saying is everything comes down to access to data, to traditional data, to alternative data. And that I fully agree. And that's also what we see. And, you know, Tactile is not a lender itself, but we build infrastructure for lenders. And so we have a lot of insights. We talk to them daily. And what we see, and that's also, Peter, what you mentioned earlier, there's a huge gap with traditional data sources and alternative data sources. And we see high demand for being able to experiment quickly with new data sources in order to pick the right data sources for the unique lending portfolio every single lender has. And this could be starting with Schufa for a very tailored segment for German customers. But for sure, everybody wants to know the customer best and have a holistic view. And therefore, maybe transaction data does make a lot of sense to pull in to make the best risk assessments and to understand the customer needs, the behavior, to make a very tailored risk assessment and to balance like risk and the rewards.
Adding more data and maybe respect to more regulations and maybe being more precise on the offering, you have to change your scoring model, your scorecard. Who's faster and more flexible to add additional data and improve the scorecard? And if a bank tells me that it needs 2 years to change anything on the scorecard, and the lender may solve this, I don't know, how fast can you be?
Today, as long as your data scientist can have a representative sample, I give it a week or two. You know, in the future, if AI does that, then probably even on the fly to experiment what are the things there.
You're calling Patrick if this is allowed, and then you're fixing it in two sprint. And
correct. I mean, then that's the agility.
The bank said, okay, maybe there's an EuGH law coming up and you have to change something. And I said, yeah, I have the additional data. You're looking for it. And yeah, but it takes 1 to 3 years to include in our processes. And coming back to Konstantin, who's a leading position, I think time to market, who has the processes built to speed up and change the behavior and be a more precise offering to the market. And it looks like that banks, maybe part of them are too slowly to adopt to the demand of the market.
But Peter, for example, what do you see as an answer to that question? So I think it's not acceptable to like take 3 years just to incorporate a new data source.
Yeah, you know, you have two issues. On one hand, are the processes built out? Yeah, maybe tomorrow inviting with Tactile to build a second journey. And if I take my perspective, we get invited, we get signed contracts, and slowly we are starting with zero integration solutions. Just the lack of resources on leading tier one enterprises. have no resources to adopt innovations. And if you connect to a lender, they are built on dynamic processes. So they are built on innovations. There's a pretty tough sprint processes. And I think it is a time against the adoption rate. I think the readiness and the willingness, the understanding still exists across the players of the market. It's a question who has the ability to drive this organization to innovations and to respect the regulations part. And that's why I'm a little bit worried that in some banks we are a little bit too not improved enough the organization. We may have to try to hold on and to change a little bit. And you have some leaders in Europe. Some banks have really built up pretty strong offerings in the market, and some other ones are really struggling to change the organization, transform the organization. Sometimes it's not about technologies, it's really about to get it time to market. Yeah.
I think that's also what we see a lot. So you can always answer the question very simple and tell all the people, oh, you need technology to solve the problem. But I think it's not the what, it's rather the how. Mm. And what we experience is that we have to do a lot of education to start to speak the same language. And then we can discuss the how can you achieve the goal of incorporating new data sources? How can you manage the new world of the API landscape? And how can you optimize the existing, maybe also legacy infrastructure, like the next level? And this is not always a revolution and a huge transformation, but this can also be like an evolution, you know, starting with super small steps towards a goal.
Tamara, you have to advise, if I'm looking back to open banking PSD2, I'm in the market since 2015. In 2017, 18, 19, every bank has decided how do we can barrier, how we can act against PSD2. It's not about acting regulation, they respect it, but can I utilize the potential out of open banking? In a majority of banks, it decided, and there have been some excuses, some leading innovator who has adopted pretty early with marketplace and API hub. But the majority moved the project to the payment departments. For payment, there was no potential for innovations in open banking. So it was just respecting the regulation part. And years after, now we have the adoption cross European banks to participate on the open banking potential. If FIDO will act the same behavior in financial institutions, we get additional data on. If the majority of the financial institutions are not consuming and adopting this potential, we'll be the same behavior. We're losing 2 to 3 years in the market, and maybe innovation like digital, like neon players, they adopt and they get into the market. They will consume it and they will exist.
And do you think, Peter, it's because we always think it is the financial institutions against the regulator? I don't know.
I think you want to
react, because I don't think it's the one against the other.
Well, no, it's about the effort. If you are so heavily regulated and have so much activities and have a limited resources, where you like to take care of, and if you are regulated to open an FINA interface and passive API in the organization, it has some activities because you have to improve your back systems, your middleware. You have to connect to some endpoints, and for sure, companies like us are coming with an FIDA server and said, "Yeah, you're live in 4 weeks. Yeah, don't worry. Yeah, standardized product, maybe following a Berlin Group definition. Then something we can cover." But at least your systems have to be able to arrange the data. But if you look on insurances, they have several databases. They have to really optimize the content itself. And there are a lot of efforts internally, which may hold back. And there was a minority in the organization or financial institution which looks for open banking opportunities, open finance opportunities. But if you overruled with the demand and regulations, it's a chicken egg story. I think there's a readiness that's interesting. Yeah, Patrick.
No, I think there's two sides to being in a regulated industry, or as heavily regulated industry as banks, because I mean, sort of the upside of it is if you have a license, you're allowed to do things that no one else does. So you know, you're sort of you have a bit of market protection. But of course, if you have a license and you're a regulated entity, everything that comes in addition from the regulator is, you know, something that costs money and you know, time, and makes things complicated. So I think it is true that not all banks or licensed players are, you know, always opposed. But you know, sometimes maybe they're a bit getting tired of, you know, implementing new regulatory frameworks. I think what you mentioned with PSD2, maybe there's a bit of a difference with FIDA. At least I hope that at least there's remuneration in it for the banks, because I think one of the flaws of PSD2 was, yeah, you have a regulatory requirement and you have to set up, you know, I won't go into the tech stuff with you guys here, but you know, the APIs and that, you know, they had to install them, but they weren't even allowed to charge anything for it. And so, weirdly enough, that will stay the same for payment account data. But sort of for everything else, that where FIDA opens the door, at least if you know, the schemes that are, you know, supposed to set up actually work, then at least they're going to be able to earn some money with it. So I hope that will, you know, make it lighter for the credit institutions to put some effort in it. Although the paper that I've read coming from them was let's say less than thrilled by what they have to implement and that it's
Petra, etc. On stage, Konstantin, yeah, on your last event you hosted, and there was a panel discussion exactly on this topic, and there's a problem. So if you have these schemes, and say, let's find the pricing, yeah. If you ask Kimo, Tamara, and myself, what about pricing? We are pretty low in pricing because we are controlling our costs. There are lean organizations, time to market, and looking on the customer demand. But if you look on huge organizations which are heavily regulated, they have huge organizations, so pretty high cost base. So if I'm asking Patrick, at the French Institute with, I don't know, 30,000 employees about the cost base, the number you're raising is far above the one we expect to be utilized in the market. And if you lead the schemes to find a market price and then escalate to the central regulation units, this will take another year. Yeah, and so I think I'm a little bit worried about the timing. And if you leave legacy companies to ask about pricing models, all the API layers on huge organizations, they're pretty cost intensive. And that's why a reason why companies like us are invited to build up innovations besides the core systems, cause on the cost level and the speed we can launch a service. So there's, I think, that's a little bit complicated, yeah, finding a price.
I'm very sure of that, although you will know a lot better than I. But yeah, I can imagine that it's going to be hard, and we'll see whether, you know, we'll fall into the fallback, you know, commission stepping in, although I don't know how they're supposed to find a pricing. But yeah, it'll be interesting to watch.
Okay, interesting discussion. Thank you very much so far. But please, let's perhaps leave this high level and let's drill a little bit deeper into disparities. And I have found a very interesting example on a disparity. And let's discuss later on a little bit more in depth about open finance and artificial intelligence against this backdrop. Three researchers from the US and Hong Kong described the pivotal role of the ethnicity of loan officers in a World Bank blog article in 2022. Just for the audience, this article is linked in the show notes. These three researchers wrote, "The discretion allowed to loan officers may significantly affect households' credit access. If the loan application is processed by a loan officer from the same ethnic group, then the probability of getting the loan is higher. However, the use of technology could change the role of loan officers in determining credit outcomes. Now, how can specifically open finance and AI help to mitigate these and perhaps even other disparities? So please, let's drill now really into the details, because we need to know what your say is on avoiding disparities.
Sure. And maybe I'll start. Well, I mean, like for the good 15 so years that I've been in lending, like at least in our case, what we've ever done, what I've seen many companies do, you eliminate humans out already from the decision making, right? So then it only comes to, what I mean is that you collect your data. Is it your account data? Whatever it is, more data, the better it is. You build a score model on it, and that is your Bible. I mean, if the model says no, then that person doesn't get, and then there's nobody in your organization who can override it. I mean, that's at least how you do mass lending, mass decisions. So, you know, it's not the old that you go to a bank and you meet the bank manager and then you talk, and then there could be human bias. But especially for fintech lending, it's been already years that it's a data science-based, statistical regression-based model, and it divides the customers into demographic groups, 1 to 10, for example, and you put your cutoff. You put your cutoff at 7, or you put it at 6, or whatever has the still favorable non-performing loan ratio that you can actually with your pricing service, and the rest just doesn't get a loan. So probably, you know, that's the way most fintechs would look at it these days. Human element has already been removed long ago. And now if you say, like, how is the future technology looking at it? How is open banking? Obviously, I look at it from more data, and the more data, the better. And now if you look at what's one of the topics was AI, right? So the AI can only do the same as a human analyst. Perhaps it does it better. Perhaps it does it on the fly, right? So it can find a lot of connections within the data, which might not come through so easily. Maybe it can create meta variables, meaning additional variables based on the normal variables that you get from the raw data. And maybe it can improve the process. Where I see it is that it would be at the scorecard building level, it'd be a symbiosis of human and machine in that sense that the data scientist still validates and looks that everything has gone right and puts it to production at this point. But the AI could monitor it and could rewrite the model on the go. So usually when we build models, we did it like, okay, there's a sample of 10,000 borrowers. We'll build the next improved when there's a sample of 20,000 borrowers and then a sample of 30. But what happens between 10 to 20,000, right? So this is where the gradual shift could be achieved, that the AI constantly on a daily basis keeps on building and figuring out. So you don't need to basically have this sort of a set. When does the human data scientist have time to go through the data, the enlarged data set?
Yeah. And Kimmo, yeah. I think at the same time, there's a huge market demand from all consumers that they want to have real-time decisions.
Correct. Correct.
That's not possible with like human decision making.
Exactly. You're absolutely right. So essentially how the process would be done is like, is it now, you know, external data service providers, like, you know, like what you guys have, or API connections, the lender would take everything in and the scorecard would be calculated in a second. If it's not calculated in a second, the customer says, well, I'm not going to wait for a decision.
Yeah,
for
if your data is not real time, how you can make
exactly
real-time.
Exactly.
It's always my argument. It does. Why should I use access to account data? So yeah, it's only real time. Yeah. It could perhaps historical data, and you don't know the gap, what happens, and you're a little bit under trouble. Up to the one you have a negative score, and it's a long journey. So with AI and finally we get more data, we have real-time data, we may have coming to constantly opening, we have more personalized offering, more precise offering, so which is good. And the other way around, there are a lot of migrants in Europe which may have no score already. So if you don't have a score, you are not serviced right now. It's very basic. I said, guys, we have real-time data. Why not using it, yeah? I say, no, if you have no score, you get no service, yeah? And then you have the negative score, but they may have already got a new job and have a good income. And so real-time data, we may improve the situation, of the profiling of the consumer with the real-time data and then make actual decision. So yeah, we can service much more and more precise and maybe on a low interest rate.
Correct. Or like if you take it, the other side is one is the better decisions, the other is fraud detection, right? So what we see is like with people are or companies are doing already in AI is they're looking at, you know, how to detect fraud through it. So what is the likelihood? Like, you know, in some cases you would have, for example, you know, you need to send a photo of yourself to, or you're verifying it, but you only, you know, the fraudsters are getting better and better. So, you know, soon you'll have deep fakes doing that. You know, you can talk to a person and it looks like, and the electronic identification may go through. So the way to combat AI is with a better AI, right? So this is where actually it might be able to detect things in data that a human credit or fraud officer will not be able to do.
We also believe that we are, you know, we are payment service, payment infrastructure service provider. So we believe with today's AI solution also we can extend the fraud management. So we track this, we found regulators, we find behaviors, yeah. But I think I fully agree with AI. We believe that there will be an improved fraud management.
Surely, one more point. KYC AML is another thing where the banks have a massive overhead these days. You know, regulators, you know, some banks have hundreds of people working on those. The correct AI systems will definitely reduce this overhead. But this is subject, of course, to the regulator again saying, hey, we're happy with a machine-based KYC and not a human-based KYC AML.
I was just going to say that especially AML monitoring is, you know, I think I'm not quite sure whether you can say it's a success story, but it works and it's used widely. And I think it wouldn't work any other way. And I'm from my little tech savvy, I think that as AI is better in actually finding irregularities that a human would never, you know, from the sheer mass of data, but also, you know, from the comparability. So I think that's a real strong point. You know, at least the German regulator accepts it. You know, not as a standalone system, obviously, but, you know, playing an important role. But so AML, I think, is a bit, you know, when we're talking about consumer credits is, you know, it's, I think it works very well there. I think for consumer credits, where it's especially, you know, you talked about creditworthiness decisions, because I think that's the core point from what I see. And I'm, you know, you're in the industry and I only advise the industry. So I have a little outside view. I think that at least, and Kimmo mentioned that earlier, I think that for the non-risk relevant loans, you know, we're talking consumer loans, smaller consumer loans, they're the regulator, the way I understand it, does accept fully automated decisions. Obviously, you know, when you get bigger numbers where it becomes, or corporates and, you know, where you have 4i principle, et cetera, there it won't work. But when we're talking about the smaller things and where consumers are tomorrow, as you said, wanting real-time decisions, I think there it can absolutely help. Maybe, I don't know, when I read it, especially in the CD3 and, you know, the GDPR, where you have this explainability thing where, you know, a consumer has to be able to ask for sort of a review and explain the logic of system. I'm you know, that's a, sort of a tech question. Can that be solved? The way I understand AI, it might be difficult, and maybe you need an explain AI to, you know, and the way I read it, BaFin might be open to that, that you have a system that explains how the other system works. But I think that's sort of a tech issue that will have to be addressed, because both the GDPR and the CCD3, you know, will allow consumers, even in loans below 200 euros, which was exempt before, you know, to you know, explain to them how the logic of the system works, which might be a tall order, you know, if you want that the consumer actually understands it.
Yeah. Oh, there are so many points I'd love to react. I don't know where to start, but maybe before we break into the huge AI universe, we can agree on a definition of AI, because what we experience a lot is that in people's minds, there's data. Data goes into a model, black box, then there's a decision, and no one knows what has happened. But that's not the case. And so if we really want to understand what's like under the hood and how does decision making work end to end, we see that's always a combination of simple business rules and AI, but AI is not the main part. Maybe the decision making process end to end is infused with a AI component to help like interpret data, to help recognize patterns, but it's not the main part of the decision-making process.
Yeah, it's an expert system, it's machine learning, yeah, and then you have some magic on top.
I think, I looked it up. AI has a definition that it uses. It's not, you know, it's a regulator's view, but they say currently it's big data, calculating resources, and machine learning put together. And that's what they consider AI. Whether that is from a tech perspective, you know, correct or even, you know, encompasses everything that there is, I doubt it, but at least that's what they're seeing. And so that's what they have an opinion on.
Anyway, if I'm looking back on us, sure, we're telling you we're using AI, but fairly said it's machine learning the last long time period, because you have a mess of data, you're getting in insights for create decisions, you want to label, you want to aggregate some reports, it's mostly machine learning, and you need an expert system. And all conversation with Credit Roots, they said, yeah, how it works, who's leading, the expert or the machines? And we always tell, yeah, it's the expert who's leading. And he made sure that the content is really precise, and then we can really control it, and we tell it. But now if you're getting in new markets and maybe you're a little bit lacking data, yeah, would AI solve some or generate some faster insights and learning? For sure it can. And then coming back to tomorrow, so who controls it? Yeah. And how do you check these? And so we have launched our AI labeling. So then this gets up to the experts, and then we're controlling what has been learned. Yeah? And then if helpfully, we adopting this to our labeling structure. And it's fair combined, but for sure it's transparent. Yeah. How the process works. And I have not seen any partner who's inviting without controlling how our system works. Yeah, so there's a huge interest.
Okay, yeah, I think we could move on in detail here. And looking at the time and the number of questions I still have on my paper, I would suggest to move a little bit forward. And one of my additional questions I have is with respect to the technology we have just been talking about is what about data protection and cybersecurity? Which role does this play here? Can you add to this?
No one wants to go first, so no, I think...
it's your part, Patrick, you know.
I'll pass the ball.
It's the fun stuff, the legal stuff.
I'll pass the ball on in a second because it was a technical... No, I think at least the GDPR part, I think I already just mentioned it, that it will, you know, once the credit decisions are based on automated processes, and especially since the European Court of Justice in the Schufa ruling, you know, broadened the scope of GDPR applicability. You know, I mean, there it wasn't even a decision; it was, you know, it was the score, and just because it was intended for use as a credit decision making basis, that was enough to make it subject to Article 22, which means, you know, you need consent or it needs to be necessary. Maybe there'll be, it doesn't make it much lighter, but the way I read it, maybe CCD3, which allows for automated creditworthiness decisions, could be one of the rules that, you know, allows such automated decision making, which doesn't help that much because CCD3 sort of provides for similar rights of the consumers. But so I think probably you will need a consent mechanism, the explainability and you know, a, sort of a more or less template for explaining how you reach your decisions. So I think that's sort of the GDPR part. As for the cybersecurity, I'm only a regulatory lawyer, so I won't comment on that. But there's, I don't know, maybe you three...
I think what's also super important to have is, again, like a common language in the industry. And that is also what we work with the DLA on, is to have industry standards for, let's say, data governance, for the new age of applying AI and open finance in decision making. And I think that's a huge chance for the entire industry just to sit together and to like have the common language and common understanding of where we have to go together, and then also divide and conquer, because you can't just master everything on your own and take the rather high level legal framework and do the entire interpretation on your own. But that's like a good thing to collaborate on.
Yeah, I guess if you take it on a global level, and GDPR could have an effect, or at least some problems, is that I don't think any, well, maybe some, but let's say I don't think there's any fintech lenders in Europe, for example, who would be able to build their own large language models. I mean, like a real AI. So essentially, I mean, I would even say that applies to banks. I mean, they might have the resources, but definitely not the capability. So what it leaves to us is essentially, you know, using interfaces to tap into the real models, which are all US-based. And essentially, you know, however you apply them on this end, you know, that the logic of those real AIs, or even if you talk about AGI at one point, AGI will come from US or China. And then the question is that if you send your customer data to be processed by a super intelligence, then, you know, what happens to GDPR? I don't think that's even doable. So I think that's definitely a consideration. What are you uploading to ChatGPT? If it's your customer data, and then of course, like, you know, if it's even on top of that, it's automated. How do you know how it makes those decisions? What data is saved? What is not saved? So surely there's a lot of consideration. So when I talk about AI in terms of fintech, perhaps I'm talking more about, you know, a very limited capability machine learning type of a tool. And not really like an AGI level, you know, Skynet type of a solution.
Yeah. And I think the AI Act, the European AI Act, will deliver some answers, but, you know, only coming in 2026.
And so that's an interesting, like, you know, in terms of innovation, in terms of, you know, where we are, Europe has totally lost its place in that race. And, you know, when you look at just, it's a bit beside the topic, but I think this all ties into the regulation and the innovation. We have a tendency here to overregulate and to be equal and to protect everyone. But at the same time, you know, trying to, for example, force same consumer directive, credit directive, CCD over the whole union and try to think everybody's aligned, you will for sure lose innovation in that. And that has happened with ChatGPT. I mean, the voice version that they have in US is far superior than what we have in Europe. And that's mainly due to our regulation that, you know, the model can't distinguish human emotion, which the US model already does. And in EU, it's not allowed.
Yeah, that's an interesting point you have just mentioned. I would like to broaden it in a way that we perhaps look into the future by imagining what will happen together with the AI regulation, together with the FIDA regulation, the EU draft regulation on financial data access, and the Consumer Credit Directive. Where do you think the ecosystem will be heading for, you know, from today in 5 years, for instance? You know, what will be the future? It's a kind of a crystal ball question. Yes, absolutely. Because it lacks practice, absolutely. But nevertheless, we know the content. And where do you think the ecosystem will be going in the future together with these opportunities?
Amazing. I think from the open banking perspective, the data protection, I think the market and the players in the market are more conservative than the consumer acts. If I look on SME and consumer, you have a very high adoption rate. And if I take on PC2, without a consent, without an opt-in, without an agreement on terms and conditions, nothing happens, because any activities always relate to a readiness of the account owner. And if you look on innovations, I think there will be on the outlook, there will be a huge adoption in embedded finance, in open finance, I fully believe in. It will be a common behavior. Yeah. To give you one example, I was staying with a banking leader of a huge group, regional, and in Niedersachsen. And he said, I would never use it. And then we found out that he's using our services since 4 years already on accounting and data ERP system. So why he wasn't aware that the embedded finance is already using, he loves it. Yeah. So this will be a common style, and who's leading? Constant, to come to your question, I think it's platforms, it's super apps, it's marketplaces. So the ecosystem itself will enrich each other, and I fully believe in that. If you place these financial homes, if you place consumer lifestyle, they will lead. And this has, in a lot of companies, have not been decided who's leading. So it's really an open game. I think pretty interesting here. But I fully believe in these platforms, and I fully believe in this embedded finance, open finance. This will take place with no excuse.
I'm pretty convinced, and that's also what we see a lot, is that all the new data sources, like leveraging open finance for decision making, is a huge opportunity for the entire market and the ecosystem to serve underserved segments and to get access to break into those segments. And on the other side, maybe also one take on AI. So we are convinced that AI is super powerful, and there is no way around, mainly also, as you mentioned, Kimmo, earlier, for fraud detection in the first place. And we have to do a lot of education on what is the best way of incorporating those powerful tool and models into the existing landscape, into the existing infrastructure, to make it accessible for all financial institutions.
Maybe I can pick up on that and what Kimmo said. Maybe I think, you know, regulation can be a chance and can be a driver of innovation. And I think what Kimmo said, you know, the big players are in the US and China. If you look at outsourcing requirements and DORA requirements for regulated entities, I don't think that will work. So maybe, you know, it will be a chance for European companies to develop AI models for that help lenders. You know, that will drive innovation in Europe in that aspect as well. That would be my hope, at least.
Cool. Yeah. I mean, I guess my crystal ball is it starts from, you know, how payments are done these days with a phone, like the close distance ones, right? So that's a really interesting sort of streamlining of a payment process, right? So these days, like 10 years ago, 5 years ago, nobody, and now everybody pays with their phone, right? So, but now in your phone, you have your credit cards in there. And then even if you go to this sort of, you know, what I say, like all the economies, I fully agree with Peter on that one, that I think the ecosystem or the kind of embedded finance that will keep on growing, you know, and taking credit will become even more seamless. And then I think the next level of paying with the phone is your own digital wallet, where you might have a digital currency in. You know, I'm not necessarily talking Bitcoin. Maybe it's just a digital euro. And then if it's in your wallet, then the open banking question is that, will you be able to share your wallet details with the lender on the go, right? So kind of like, if you think of the streamlined process, like fully streamlined, you don't need to have and you know, you put in there that France, for example, is at the moment putting everything IDs digital. So your passport will be digitally on your phone, your IDs will be your driver's license, all of this will be on your phone. And so if you think about it, that you know, on the go, you need to buy something, and you know, you haven't applied for credit, but you know, kind of like an advanced buy now, pay later. You know, everything is in your wallet, everything, all your transaction data, your cash, your salary, everything comes into your wallet. And then all your IDs and everything is there. And you would be just saying, hey, I want to get a new bicycle. Here you go. And the moment everything is done, and there you go.
I think in 5 years, coming back to the opening, now 2 or 3 decisions are manually about hybrid and digital journeys. I think in 5 years, will be the other way around. So there will be, I would bet 2 or 3 decisions will be digital, and you will be hybrid processes. And so also we see the same behavior that Neon offering started. and fully digital and understand that you need a hybrid. So you need some call center, you need some agents, you need some stuff on personal advice. So there will be a hybrid beside, but the majority definitely in 5 years will be digital decisions.
And that goes already to a different topic of you know, decentralized finance that, you know, today everything is built on the banks, right? So you need to get the open banking, the banks on board. But what if you're your own banker, you know, in that sense that your wallet is your phone and it's your identity and, you know.
Consumer right now, not aware that they have so many credits right now. Yeah? They think that if they're in a media Saturn market and starting a BNPL process, they're not aware that there's a credit line. Yeah, so there's a...
And I mean, and if you carry everything with you, right, then if your credit score is you, who you are digitally, your digital ID, you know, and if you can carry it, for example, in blockchain with you, going really deep into a crystal ball, then if you're a digital nomad or a gig worker, then essentially you can go from here to Sweden or, you know, from Sweden to Bali, and you carry that credit worthiness or lack of with you, you know, so it may open even a more of a global market in that sense. So, but yeah, this is very crystal ballish now.
But it's a wonderful idea, and let's perhaps stop it here for the moment. As I have seen, we have so many interesting things to discuss, and there are so many more items on the agenda that we need to do next time. But yeah, Kimmo, thank you very much for these wonderful final words. No, we have come to the end of our podcast now. Thank you very much for your time, Tamara, Kimmo, Peter, and Patrick. It was a pleasure to have you in our show.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Konstantin.
Thank you.
Many thanks. Many thanks for setting up.
Thank you, everyone, for listening. I hope you have also enjoyed this episode. Please make sure you subscribe to our podcast and follow us on LinkedIn so that you will never miss our podcast. Stay safe and sound, and see you soon in 2025. Happy New Year.